My name is Ralph Jorsch, and it's my pleasure to introduce Professor Rod Preece of the Political Science Department at Wilfrid Laurier University. Professor Preece holds a doctoral degree from the University of Leicester and has taught at the universities of Surrey and Leicester, Mannheim, and Waterloo. I assume that most of us could guess that Surrey and Leicester were in England, Mannheim was in Germany, and Waterloo in Ontario. In addition to his position at Wilfrid Laurier University, he is Maurice Young Invited Research Scholar in the Center for Applied Ethics at UBC. He's the author, co-author, and editor of books on German politics, European socialization, animal welfare, and political theory, which is quite a diverse field. His most recent book, which has been published courtesy of UBC Press, Animals and Nature, Cultural Myths and Cultural Realities, is the product of 6 years of intensive research into comparative religion, literature, philosophy, anthropology, mythology, ethology, and animal welfare science. The book is published and is for sale in the lobby, and he will be pleased to autograph copies that you wish to purchase. I'm looking forward to this evening's presentation, and I am with you in hoping that this is not going to be an academic writing for other academics. We assume that there will be popular interest in this, and I'm looking forward to this lecture. May I introduce Professor Rod Preece, please.
Well, let me say first how delighted I am to have been invited to address you this evening. The Vancouver Institute, as you know better than I, is a venerable institution with a most impressive lineage. Its reputation really is beyond parallel. I know of no other institution, either in Canada or in Britain, which fulfills such a role. Unfortunately, unlike some of your previous speakers, I am not a Nobel laureate, or an appeal court judge, or the Dalai Lama, but I can assure you that when I return to Ontario, I shall not mention any of my shortcomings. I shall merely tell my associates of the great company I may now number myself among. I don't think they'll think I'm the Dalai Lama anyway. My real pleasure this evening, though, is to be able to cheat on my wife. Lorna would never have allowed me to wear my lucky red tie with a blue shirt. Please don't tell her I did. To mangle a metaphor, when the cat's away, red and blue match. I must say, though, that when I received the invitation to address you, I did have some qualms about the date. October the 30th, the night before Halloween, Devil's Night. Well, I wondered whether I was being cast as the devil. Whether it was intentional or not, I do indeed acknowledge that I am the devil. To the advocacy intellectuals and to the devotees of political correctness. Advocacy intellectuals are those who promote a particular ideology in the guise of scholarly inquiry. And it's appalling and amazing just how many of them there are out there. Incidentally, if you can't see my horns, it's because I'm a very junior devil. and you have to get up close to recognize them. And I comb my hair carefully so that the horns are hidden. In a friendly review I received this week of my new book, it said, I was too polite. I refrained from calling my intellectual foes on their political correctness. Well, if I was too polite in the book, I will be less polite this evening. My claim is that advocacy intellectualism and political correctness are the very negation of a healthy intellectual life. They constitute a return to the modes of thought of the Inquisition, to unquestionable orthodoxy, and to replacing the striving for knowledge with the fear of offending some ideological norm imposed by a self-righteous intellectual elite. What I shall be talking about this evening is what Charles Dickens, in his novel Our Mutual Friend, called podsnappery. Podsnappery is the practice in debate and argument of choosing a hero, whether that hero is a person, a class, a nation, a culture, and construing all the evidence to fit into one's preconceptions. In short, it's rationalization. And it has become a common practice in a certain type of contemporary academic literature. Rationalization. Rationalization or podsnappery replaces an honest endeavor to seek the ascertainable reality. I would like to have said ascertainable truth, but these days all kinds of radical relativists, from cynical Hobbesians to self-righteous postmodernists, deny the existence of truth, which always makes me wonder whether they think they are expressing a truth when they deny there is a truth. I mean, clearly, the hypothesis fails, whichever way you take it. Well, who are the podsnappers? For one, our new coeval Governor General, John Ralston Saul. In his book, Voltaire's Bastards, he proclaims rationalism to be universal in the Western tradition, and he pretends to stand above others in making this important discovery. Well, what's rationalism? Well, like most abstract words, it has a variety of meanings depending on the mood or interests of who's using it. One is inclined sometimes to think of the person who uses the word as Humpty Dumpty in The Walrus and the Carpenter, when Humpty Dumpty says, when I use a word, it means just whatever I choose it to mean, nothing more, nothing less. Well, Ralston Saul uses the term rationalism in that way, but nonetheless, generally speaking, it is the idea that we acquire all our knowledge through reason, and it's this which raises us above those beings whose lives are not based on reason. And John Ralston Saul tells us that this idea is universal in the Western tradition. Didn't you read Genesis? Or the book of Job? Or William Blake? Or Rousseau? Or John Keats? Or Swedenborg? Or Samuel Butler? Or William Wordsworth? Or Ibsen? And so on. The list is just legion. In fact, anti-rationalism, the notion that feelings and instinct and intuition constitute the human essence, has in fact played a very important part in the Western tradition. It shouts out in the writings of Edgar Allan Poe, John Steinbeck, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, Carl Jung, and many, many more. Even in popular fiction, Mary Gordon, in her delightful novel, The Company of Women, has this wonderful, sublime sentence. She says, "Our age has put its trust in reason, and reason is a whore. She goes with anyone." You know, point is this, that Mary Gordon is making the point that when one trusts to reason alone, it must be at the expense of intuition, loyalty, and community. Well, surely John Ralston Saul cannot be unaware of this significant aspect of the Western tradition. So why does he ignore it? Well, quite simply because it doesn't fit in with his preconceptions. If he acknowledged it, his thesis would be weakened. So he ignores it. So how does all this relate to harmony with animals and nature? Took me a while to get there, didn't it? First, in much of the animal and nature-oriented literature, there is a pervasive assumption that the Western cultural tradition is one of dominance over animals and nature. And this arises from, so it's said, an arrogant Western rationalism. But why does all that literature ignore so much in our tradition? Why, for example, does it ignore Rousseau when he writes in Emile, "How do we let ourselves be moved by compassion if not by transporting ourselves outside of ourselves and identifying with the suffering animal by leaving, as it were, our own being to take on its being?" Well, if we read any of the animal rights literature, we'll find lots of references to nasty Descartes and disgusting Malebranche, but I don't recall in any one of those books ever seeing those words from Rousseau. Again, why does the animal advocacy literature ignore the lengthy tradition of those who have written against experimentation on animals? It's a remarkable list, which you won't find mentioned in Peter Singer's Animal Liberation or any of the books in that vein. Again, you'll find lots of critical references to the insensibilities of Descartes and Boyle, and to the barbarities of the Jansenist seminarians who nailed a dog to a board to see the circulation of blood. Plenty of that kind of stuff. But no reference at all to those who were appalled by experimentation on animals. And the list is really quite remarkable. The people who wrote against experimentation on animals, and of course, admittedly, must remember, this is in the days before anesthetic, so it's not as though we're talking about the same thing today, but those who wrote against it included Samuel Pepys, the great diarist, Alexander Pope, John Evelyn, Dr. Samuel Johnson, Jonathan Swift, Henry Fielding, Christina Rossetti, Mark Twain, Robert Browning, Lord Tennyson, Robert Louis Stevenson, Thomas Hardy, Wilkie Collins, George Bernard Shaw, and even C.S. Lewis. Huge list. And that's, you know, not trying to fill out a list. Those are just some of the more prominent. To offer you just a snippet, Robert Browning remarked that he would rather submit to the worst of deaths, so far as pain goes, than have a single dog or cat tortured on the pretense of sparing me a twinge or two. Robert Louis Stevenson opposed an experiment on the proverbial guinea pig, even though that experiment was designed to develop a cure for a serious illness from which Robert Louis Stevenson himself suffered. You know, why, we have to ask ourselves, is none of this mentioned in the advocacy books on animals and nature? Ignorance? Possibly. Podsnappery? Certainly. Political correctness? Certainly. It is now de rigueur to denigrate the Western tradition and to elevate all other traditions. In fact, even the rationalists in the Western tradition have found a significant space for the animals. For example, the 18th century feminist Mary Wollstonecraft asks, in what does man's preeminence over the brute creation consist? And her reply to her own question was unequivocal. She says, the answer is as clear as that half is less than a whole in reason. Yet, she considered it an essential part of education to teach consideration, the virtue of consideration, for other species. John Locke is always taken as the exemplar of the rationalist tradition, and rightly so. And yet, he says, there are some brutes that seem to have as much knowledge and reason as some that are called men. We shall find everywhere that the several species are linked together and differ but in almost insensible degrees. And already at the end of the 16th century, that harbinger of the scientific revolution, Sir Francis Bacon, was proclaiming that, and I'm quoting him, the inclination of goodness is imprinted deeply in the nature of man, insomuch that it will take unto itself other living creatures. Well, if rationalism is the peculiar Western vice, then it's a vice which has had some surprising benefits for the animals. It culminates, actually, in the declaration of Wolfgang Goethe in 1819, who says that each animal is an end in itself, developing the Kantian notion. The point is that you will not find in any of the advocacy literature any reference to those words from Locke, or Bacon, or Goethe, or any of them. In fact, and it seems to me a very important fact of the Western tradition, that by recognizing each animal as an end in itself, possessing its own dignity, its own worth, its own grandeur, that we cease to understand animals merely in relation to ourselves, but instead we understand them as entities in themselves with their own species-specific needs. And this is precisely the value of the ethological and animal welfare science research which is now being undertaken. It allows us to understand what an animal's needs and interests are. And of course, there's a long way to go. But rationalism and science are opening doors for animal well-being that is outside the purview of other traditions of thought. Now, to be sure, we need to bring together the rationalist and anti-rationalist traditions. What I would like to entitle, in fact, instead of using those words, I prefer to talk about the sympathetic and empathetic traditions. That the scientific approach is a sympathetic one, the anti-scientific approach is an empathetic one. We need to bring them together if we're to have a healthy attitude toward animals and nature. It cannot be complete without marrying objective respect, sympathy, with a sense of being a part of, belonging, as in that quotation from Rousseau, which is empathy. You know, ultimately marrying instinct and feeling with science and reason. And if marriage between them isn't yet even logically possible, then a bit of fooling around wouldn't be a bad start. So while the ethologists and animal welfare scientists are grinding away at their research, producing practical benefits for animals, there's an abundance of podsnappers out there posing as intellectuals, but functioning as advocates, decrying everything Western, scientific and rationalist, and lauding everything else. In fact, advocacy anthropology, and that term is George Wentzel's proud self-description in his book on the Inuit, is now a common and unfortunately respectable term. Yet, and you notice I'm quoting a lot from literature, and there's a particular reason for that. You know, we tend often as philosophers to think that the philosophical truths are there in philosophy. My experience is that they're in literature much more carefully expressed than in philosophy itself. And so, 2¼ centuries ago, Tobias Smollett, in his novel, The Expedition of Humphrey Clinker, got it absolutely right when he wrote, "The fumes of faction not only disturb the faculty of reason, but also pervert the organs of sense." That seems to me to be remarkably prescient, writing in 1771, remarkable. But what he's saying, of course, is that through advocacy, we become rationalizers. Not only in our judgments, but in what we imagine we witness, and therefore in what we report. We not only mislead others, we succeed in misleading ourselves. We don't seek reality. We seek whatever is convenient to the ideology we advance. Now, unfortunately, many of those who have written on harmony with animals and nature misrepresent the Western tradition, which they invariably condemn by one-sided, out-of-context interpretations. Aristotle and St. Augustine are the worst sufferers, totally misinterpreted by taking just one short quotation, always out of context. And they equally misrepresent the Aboriginal and Oriental traditions, which, when they are wise, as they often are eulogized as though that were the whole of that tradition. And when they are self-interested and destructive, as they also often are, then their practices are ignored, or at the very best, explained away, justified, usually on the grounds of tradition. You know, if it were not such a serious matter, it would have been jocular to witness David Suzuki and Vinay Deloria and others performing intellectual somersaults to justify the macaw killing of the whale, jumping on its tail in unfeigned glee and using the flesh not for sustenance but for profit. Now, even the besotted Captain Ahab in Herman Melville's Moby Dick treated the hated white whale with more respect than the macaw. It's not the behavior of the macaw that really concerns me. What concerns me is people like Suzuki and Deloria. You know, the defense that they use is tradition. Well, surely, if tradition is in and of itself a justification, then the West must be justified in its sexism and its racism and its appalling hunting of elephants for their ivory, commercial fishing to nigh extirpation, none of which I hope is considered justifiable by anyone here. It is, in fact, quite admirable to respect tradition. The Navajo writer, Emily Benedek, I think she put it brilliantly. She said, when one doesn't know the traditions, one has nothing to light one's way. But if you think what Benedek is actually saying, it's this, that the traditions are the light. They're not the way itself. You know, traditions, whether Aboriginal or Oriental or Western, are the illuminating context of action. But the action itself always has to be judged by whether it promotes or hinders justice. And when the actions deny justice, they must eventually be abandoned. Ultimately, to defend a tradition merely because it is a tradition is to defend Nazi genocide because of the traditional Aryan blood myth. And I hope we would all find that an appalling tradition. Traditions can be good or bad. The point is that they're the light, though, not the path. There are two points I really must clarify before I go any further. And the first is that the sins of the West are at least as great, and often greater, than those of other traditions. Its technological power has guaranteed it to be so, rather than the intrinsic culture itself. And the second point is that the motives of many of those who condemn the West and eulogize Aboriginal and Oriental traditions are admirable. The desire is as old as morality itself, to side with the oppressed, to resurrect the image of those unjustly maligned, to cock a snook at traditional Western conceits, in short, to right a wrong. But those admirable motives have resulted in the painting of a caricature, not a portrait. Advocacy almost always does that. Indeed, defense lawyers, professional advocates, in seeking to represent their clients, obscure, deliberately obscure, their client's reality in the manner most advantageous to their client. Unfortunately, intellectual advocates have come to function as defense lawyers. I hope there aren't too many lawyers in the audience if I quote from George Eliot's The Mill on the Floss, when she tells us that in contrast to the good animals, which are created by God, there were bad animals who were created by the devil. Well, what were the bad animals? Well, she has three: rats, weevils, and lawyers. Well, if I'm to be cast as the devil by the devotees of political correctness, I thought I'd take my revenge in kind on the advocacy scholars, those who function as lawyers. Which reminds me of that wonderful quip from Voltaire, quite apposite to what I'm talking about. Voltaire said this: God made man in his own image, but man has taken his revenge in kind. The reason that that, I think, is quite apposite is because the advocacy scholars create their heroes, their gods, in their own image. That is, they make their heroes hold the views that they themselves hold. Rousseau put it very nicely. He said, a philosopher loves the Tartars in order to be spared having to love one's neighbors. Rousseau's philosopher, in other words, identifies himself against his neighbors with those he has set up as his ideal. And when the heroes don't measure up to the ideal, then he adjusts their views and their practices to make them fit. Now, this advocacy intellectualism is not something new. One can really go back to the 8th century BC and see it in Hesiod. But nonetheless, that with regard to the glorification, misrepresentation, romanticization of the Aboriginal tradition, you can see it already with Peter Martyr and Montaigne in the 16th century. And of Oriental traditions, we see it with John Oswald and George Nicholson at the end of the 18th century. But I would suggest that there has been, in intellectual history, Western and Eastern, a contrary, much wiser, lengthy intellectual voice which understood that, despite differences of culture, human beings of whatever origin or tradition are essentially similar. That differing cultures serve to mask the reality of homogeneity. That cultures are, in fact, different approaches to serving the same human ends. That we are all, in fact, of a common species with common human needs and are all much more alike than dissimilar. You know, even animal welfare scientists tend to forget that you know, the humans are animals too, and that the humans have certain species-specific needs. But if you look at the Western tradition, you see that view in Plato, in St. Augustine, Samuel Johnson, in the utilitarians, excluding Herbert Spencer, in Kant, in Thoreau, in Coleridge, in Freud. But you also see it in the Persian De Satir, the Hindu Bhagavad Gita, the Chinese Tao Te Ching. They all subscribed to that doctrine. Today, the purveyors of cultural distinctiveness are in the ascendancy. But I think it's important to recall that earlier and wiser tradition. The human is an animal with species-specific needs, drives, motives, and purposes to which culture is always subservient. Now, C.S. Lewis put it very well. He said, "Humans constantly forget that they are animals, and that whatever their bodies do affects their souls, or minds, if you prefer the term." But really, I think it's very important. And it's true, and it doesn't matter what race, what culture, what ethnicity, the same basic reality is there. In other words, human behavior, I'm saying, is despite differences in culture, differences in myth, differences in story, it's always more alike than dissimilar. The differences are there, they're real, culture is certainly real, but the differences are much more nuanced and subtle than we commonly imagine. Well, I've been making a lot of generalizations about these pod snappers, but what about the specifics? Well, let me start with an example from Knutson and Suzuki. You know, since I'm in Suzuki's hometown and where he has so many admirers, I thought I might as well take the bull by the horns, so to speak. Following the lead of such books as Timothy Severin's Vanishing Primitive Man, 1973, Thomas Berry, The Dream of the Earth, 1988, David Mabry Lewis in his Millennium, Tribal Wisdom in the Modern World, or following that, Knutson and Suzuki, in their book, The Wisdom of the Elders, portray Aboriginal attitudes in utopian terms. They employ the Kayapo Indians of the Amazonian heartlands of Brazil as one of their many examples of Aboriginal societies which they say are in mystical union with nature. And so they tell us, deeply embedded within their nature-embracing myths are timeless beliefs that pay homage to ancient reciprocal relationships among animals, plants, and human beings. And then they follow this by saying that Kayapo women color their faces with paint mixed with the bodies of red ants. It is a gesture of respect, perhaps even a prayer, lovingly addressed to the entire kingdom of red ants. Well, it might strike us as somewhat incongruous, it certainly strikes me as incongruous anyway, that the killing of ants for decorative purposes could be described without any apparent qualms as a gesture of respect to the ants the Kayapo have killed and others of their species. You know, the point is that it may be, I don't know, we're entitled to an explanation. And that's precisely what we're never given. Why should the killing of ants be mysteriously considered respectful of them? You know, what we really need to be told is how it differs from the Occidental wearing of fur when the person wearing the fur coat tells you, how wonderful are those animals whose coats are now being worn? Seems to me to be exactly the same point. Now, we might want to say, well, ants don't really matter. You know, they're not complex sentient beings. Well, if you want to make that point, then we have to ask of those who applaud Brazilian aboriginals for their respectful killing of ants, whether their removal of plumage from captured wild birds, also for decorative birds, is similarly respectful. We must ask what it is in the apparent disregard of the aboriginals for the interests of the animals that distinguishes them from their Western counterparts. And in the advocacy literature, we are never told. You know, there is no clearer instance, in my view, of misrepresentations of reality than in the citation of the famous ecology speech from Chief Seattle of the Duwamish, delivered around 1853. In fact, we have little reliable evidence of what it was that Chief Seattle actually said. What we have is a report from a certain Henry Smith, who wrote an article about the speech some 30-odd years after it was delivered. But in book after book after book today, we can read of Chief Seattle's profound statements that all things in nature are connected, that all living beings share the same breath. Well, if we actually take the trouble to read Henry Smith's 1887 article, then we'll find that there are no such statements. They quite simply are not there, and yet are quoted in book after book after book. In fact, the claim that everything in nature is linked together comes from Jean d'Alembert's Encyclopedia of 1772. We can also find it in the writings of Cézanne and Victor Hugo and John Ruskin and John Steinbeck, as well as earlier in those of the philosophers Leibniz and Locke. Again, the view that all have one breath doesn't come from Seattle. It actually comes from the Bible. It's Ecclesiastes 3, verse 19. That which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts. They all have one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence over a beast. So the supposed profound aboriginal expressions of respect that we get every time we see Chief Seattle being quoted are in fact Western cultural expressions. Clearly, the Western academics who misreport such statements as though they are aboriginal statements fail to apply normal, even undergraduate standards of scholarship. They just don't bother to go and look at the source and read the material, and it's there. Not difficult to find it. So, why don't they do it? Well, it's because of their commitment to a cause. They accept uncritically as reliable evidence whatever is conducive to the interests of their cause. If it confirms it, they don't bother going any further. Well, I would argue that in fact, by depicting Aboriginal culture in such erroneous and misleading terms, then the advocacy intelligentsia are doing the natives a profound disservice. They're not seen as they are in all their subtleties and complexities, their contrarieties and their tensions, their yearnings and their self-doubts, their virtues and their vices. In other words, they're not seen in their humanity. They're instead reduced to a symbol, coerced into the conceptual boxes designed for them by an engagé branch of the Western intelligentsia. They become not the complex human beings that they are, with all the contradictions and tensions of all other human beings. Instead, they are made into an ideological instrument of those who vaunt them. They are reduced to functioning as a political tool. And if we are to be intellectually honest, we must indeed respect Aboriginals for their many admirable cultural attitudes. But we must also, if we're to be intellectually honest, report the profoundly negative aspects of their traditions too. You know, Seneca Indians built longhouse villages by burning the trees to form an open area for cultivation and to secure wood for fuel and consumption. After no more than 20 years, the Seneca had to move on, for the land was exhausted and denuded. The Mandans and Hidatsas migrated in a 400-year period from the middle reaches of the Missouri into the North Dakota heartland. Each move was undertaken because the land and wood supply had been exhausted. Sioux broke camp several times a month, so rapidly were sources depleted. And Maya diverted waterways to satisfy royal desires with the inevitable environmental consequences. Now, tribal societies customarily control nature as much as they are able, and often to nature's lasting detriment. Now, to be sure, when the populations are small, the land may have a good chance to recover. But the point is that nonetheless, humans are much more alike than those who glorify Aboriginal environmentalism would have us believe. Traditional attitudes to animals should also give us cause for concern. Seneca Indians celebrated the New Year by strangling a white dog, one of a breed kept specially for the purpose, daubing its lifeless body with red paint and decorating it with a garland of white beads and then hanging it from a pole. Now, I can give you lots of 18th century French examples which are just as deplorable. The point that I'm making is that Western intellectuals try to depict the Aboriginal societies as though it never happened and depict the Western society as though it was the norm. The Navajo prepared an antidote to a potential poisonous spell being cast upon them, and they concocted it from the gallbladders of mountain lions, bears, eagles, and skunks, which were sometimes killed to fulfill that function alone. And the Hopi ceremony of the Nemankachina culminates in the ritual killing by suffocation of eagles they have previously captured. And the Maya sacrificed jaguars, and for at least 1,000 years they captured quetzals and hummingbirds and toucans to use their feathers for personal adornment. And the Xavante of the Upper Zingo in Brazil kept harpy eagles in cages to provide a supply of the prized decorative feathers, rubbing an unguent on the plucked birds to promote the growth of new plumes. And one could go on at considerable length. I mean, the number of examples is endless. And of course, I could give you an equally lengthy list, probably a lengthier list, of Western misuse. I don't have to do that. We all take it for granted of the Western misuse. The point is, what I'm saying is that misuse is pretty common. And the notion of trying to create heroes just does not give us a handle on reality. Now, faced with such evidence, the advocacy intellectuals, first of all, will fail to report it. But if pressed, they will tell us that any less than wholesome elements of Aboriginal culture are post-contact behavior. In fact, all of the examples I have just given you are all pre-contact examples. Now, when bison were plentiful, North American Indians would drive whole herds of them over a cliff to their destruction, up to 900 killed at a time, according to archaeological evidence. In excavations of kill sites, it's been found that many of the limb bones were whole and spinal columns were often intact. This suggests mass killings, far more than the natives could consume, and considerable waste. Well, very much like we did with whales. Point is that in defense of such practices, the advocacy academics will tell us that the inordinate number of deaths reflects not a lack of concern, but a lack of technology, an inability to control the numbers killed. Well, right, absolutely, indeed. But if that is so, then one cannot argue, as is so frequently argued, that no more are killed than can be consumed. You see that phrase in almost all the literature. Nor that all of the animal is used. It quite simply wasn't. Now, what I'm saying is that Amerindian profligacy and Western profligacy are very, very much alike. And we customarily condemn the West, but constantly forget that others behave in a similar manner. Well, I've been talking of Amerindian behavior in large part because we tend to be more interested in those close to us. Yet very similar points could be made about most other Aboriginal societies. Samoans kept birds in captivity to provide decorative feathers to adorn their mats. Australian Aborigines poisoned water holes with the petori plant to snare emus, but of course killed many other animals as well, unintentionally and without using them. Polynesian sailors ate to extinction several flightless bird species they encountered on the smaller islands they discovered. Through soil erosion, the Maoris destroyed the ecological basis for the shellfish diet they had once enjoyed. They extinguished all 11 species of moa and cut down half the forests. Now, goats and chickens are sacrificed in the Kivu province of Zaire to bring harm to tribal and personal enemies. The Kwayo of Mylaita in the Solomon Islands sacrifice pigs in homage to their ancestors. The list is endless. What should be of special interest to us is not that these things are practiced. Again, one could say we can think every bit of many even worse things in the West. What should be of a special interest, though, is the misleading manner in which these practices are described. There is no more pernicious word than sacred in the advocacy lexicon. If an animal is misused, we can confidently expect to be told that it is sacred. Even the best of anthropologists occasionally succumb to the misleading use of the word. Well, according to the Concise Oxford Dictionary, notice I don't get the big one, the concise one is quite enough. Sacred means safeguarded, or required by religion, or reverence, or tradition, indefeasible, inviolable, sacrosanct. Well, as an exemplary use of sacred in the animal context, one might turn to the statement of Göran Borenholt, a famous anthropologist, about the Turaya of Indonesia. He says, to the Turaya, the water buffalo is the most sacred of all animals, and it is also the principal symbol of wealth. Buffaloes are bred for one single purpose, to be sacrificed during funerary ceremonies. Well, whatever meaning sacred may have in that quotation, it cannot include safeguarded, or indefeasible, or inviolable, or sacrosanct. After all, the animal is bred for one sole purpose, its own sacrifice. The buffalo's carotid artery is cut with a long knife, and the sacred animal is allowed to bleed to death. As many as 250 animals may be killed in a single funeral ceremony for an important person. Whatever sacred may mean for the Turaya, it must be the very antithesis of what it meant for William Blake and Albert Schweitzer, both of whom said, life itself is sacred. Now, for the Turaya and countless other Aboriginal societies, what is sacred is put to death to appease the spirits, and not the spirits of the buffalo. It's this. It is the ritual of sacrificing the buffalo which is sacred, not the buffalo itself. The buffalo is merely a means to a sanctified end. To describe it as sacred is to mislead. The ritual is sacred, the animal is not. This customary use of sacred by anthropologists simply obscures the reality. It inculcates in us a positive attitude toward behavior which we would otherwise find inexcusable. Well, in Through the Looking Glass, Lewis Carroll puts in the mouth of Humpty Dumpty the following words. When I make a word do a lot of extra work like that, I always pay it extra. Well, I'm suggesting the word sacred deserves a tremendous salary increase. Well, given all this evidence, why is it that the advocacy academics continue to describe Aboriginal attitudes to animals in nature in such unilateral and glowing terms? It's in fact because they listen to Aboriginal societal myths instead of relying on the evidence of behavior. And societal myths serve to mislead. They are, at most, evidence of societal aspirations. How would we respond if someone were to describe the West as altruistic and peace-loving? Well, say the least, we'd be amused, in fact, quite astonished, and we'll consider the person has totally misrepresented Western reality. And so, of course, we'd say, what's your evidence? Well, the person would say back to us, in Matthew 7, verse 12, it says, all things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do you even so to them. And in Matthew 5:39 it says, whoever shall smite thee on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. Well, when we hear that, we say the person was being preposterous. You know, we'd say, how absurd to draw a correlation from the exhortations of the New Testament to the behavior and attitudes of Westerners. Yet, if we rely on Aboriginal myths as evidence for Aboriginal attitudes, as so many do, then we commit exactly the same mistake. Aspirations and ideals, and they're wonderful aspirations and ideals, but that's all they are, just as Matthew 7 and Matthew 5 are wonderful aspirations, but bear very little relationship to the reality of Western society. Now, it would be most unfortunate if anything I have said were to encourage a return to the West's former and sometimes still continuing prejudiced sense of cultural superiority. The point is not at all to eulogize the West, but to indicate that human behavior everywhere has more in common than we are sometimes led to believe. We must all re-examine and reorient our attitudes toward a genuine respect, and we must not rely for our models on misrepresentations of supposedly superior orientations in other societies. You know, clearly, Aboriginal culture contains many truly admirable elements, from Mayan and Andean architecture and textile weaving, Dogon communitarianism and astronomy, San egalitarianism, Mongol hospitality, Tlingit conceptions of justice, the sense of community and the X-ray art of Australian Aborigines, you know, the honor of the Zulu, the courage of the Maasai, to the great legends, tribal dignity and reverential mystique, which are the central elements of tribal culture generally. But let us admire Aboriginal cultures for what they are, not what it is nice to believe about them when those claims are countered by the evidence. If we are to rethink our way to a wiser life in a healthy and respected natural environment, as we must if humanity is to survive, it's essential that we begin by eliminating our prejudgments. And that means that we must recognize the evidence for what it is, not what we romantically imagine it to be. Now, I've said nothing about Oriental traditions, which, like Aboriginal traditions, are full of glories and beauties, as well as appalling mistreatment of animals and the environment. And much as I'm enamored of some aspects of Oriental traditions, I've said quite enough for one evening. So I'll leave the Buddhists and the Hindus and the Taoists and the Jains for another occasion. But to those who would glorify the traditions of India, let me offer you a very telling sentence from Gandhi. Gandhi said, "The ideal of humanity in the West is perhaps lower, but their practice of it very much more thorough than ours. We rest content with a lofty ideal and are slow or lazy in its practice. We are wrapped in deep darkness, as is evident from our paupers, cattle, and other animals." So let me say in conclusion that all societies have manipulated and misused animals and nature. Yet, on the other hand, each brings a nuanced and subtle difference to bear on our appropriate relationships to animals and nature. Instead of denigrating the West and lauding other societies, it seems to me that it's imperative that we recognize that all, Aboriginals, Orientals, and Westerners alike, have much to learn from each other. So finally, let me, as a vegetarian who occasionally cheats, apologize for biting at the sacred cows of the Podsnappers. Tomorrow I shall do penance. This evening I've indulged in chewing the flesh a little. Thank you.
I'm sure that he's provoked a good deal of questioning in the audience, and now is your time to ask the questions. Dr. Clark.
I'd like to ask, do you have one or two philosophers who particularly embrace the outlook toward animals that you advocate?
Quite simply, no. The question was whether I had any particular philosophers who I would suggest as a whole advocate the principles that I would advocate. No, though probably Goethe, who's not a philosopher, of course, but probably Goethe comes closest to it. In Goethe's poem Divinity, written about 1803. What he makes clear is that up until his own time, he says the questions of religion are about the relationship between man and God. And he says now the religious questions are about the relationship between humans and animals. And I think in that, yes, that's where Goethe captures me.
Yes.
Well, given that there may be some things that we badly need to change as neighbors, are you against, I guess, all advocacy by intellectuals or just sloppy advocacy?
It's a very good question. Yeah, no, I'm not against advocacy. I'm against advocacy when the person includes it within the work rather than uses the work to suggest that certain ends ought to be achieved. No, I'm not against advocacy. Yes. The question is about whether Buddhism has essentially a sense of a life in harmony with animals and nature. I think the reality is that many Western intellectuals have recently attempted to change Buddhism to be that. I don't think that Buddhism in and of itself, in its own traditions, is necessarily so. Though I do think there are some remarkable aspects within it. Now, I think Buddhism probably would come second to Jainism in terms of what it expresses as aspirations. But in its practices, I doubt that it comes as close as well, certainly not as close, doesn't meet the Jains. I doubt if the Buddhist practices ever come anywhere near meeting their aspirations. Let me give you just one obvious, well, two obvious examples in which they don't. If you go to the statue of the four-faced Buddha in Bangkok, you will see people lining up to purchase birds to release them from the cages. And then other Buddhists around the corner capturing the birds and putting them back in cages to sell them again. Buddhist priests who are vegetarians will always accept as alms any flesh food. And that seems to me that what happens within Buddhism, despite its ideals, is that it comes to rationalize and to behave very much in the way that most other traditions behave. Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
Just one observation. The so-called harmony, the liaison, if you like, between Amerindian peoples and nature, you talked about it coming, I think, in essence, from what we read about Indian legends, what the Indians say about themselves, their own tradition. You didn't mention, and perhaps for good reason, the people in about the 1920s, Worf, Sapir, Boas, and these other anthropologists, who in recording the American Indian languages, felt that they saw a core of nature not found in Western languages, such as the passivity toward nature. And I think these people had a big impact on our perception of American Indians, the Amerindian peoples, through what they said, because of what they said about their language, which was much more deeply ingrained in the human psyche than, say, some myth that somebody invented. So I just wonder if you want to make a comment on that?
I would agree wholeheartedly with you. I think that's precisely what happened, yes. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's very true. But tell me, I think the French example is a French revolutionary example is a good one. How would you explain Peter Martyr and Montaigne? The late, well, those who were writing from the 1490s to the end of the 16th century, who were taking the same position, because there wasn't a similar revolutionary situation then. And I don't know what the answer is. Perhaps it was simply in revulsion at the horrendous way in which the Amerindians were being treated by the conquistadors. But all I'm saying is there is no revolutionary situation at that time which produces the same. Oh. Absolutely, yes. The idea of the noble savage goes back certainly to Hesiod. In the 8th century BC, and when Hesiod talks about it, he uses something which indicates he's quoting from two extant oral myths, which are quite different, and so it's even older than that, and there are impressive hints about it, both in the Iliad and, in the Iliad in particular, yeah. Can't remember, but if you want to drop me a line, I'll find it for you.
We have a question there.
I don't want to go putting words into anybody's mouth, but somebody like David Suzuki perhaps might say that their ends justify their
Question?
Well, this is a good question. He was suggesting that David Suzuki might respond by saying that the ends justify the means. Well, of course, I mean, it was Machiavelli who started that kind of thing. Whether the ends justify the means or not, and that I think is a different question than the one I've been addressing, and that is that if we take the approach that the ends justify the means, then we will never have any understanding of what it is that we ought to be doing. Because we will always be interpreting it to meet the ends that we wish to see.
I would now like to call on Mr. Peter Milroy, Director of UBC Press, to extend our thoughts.
For the last 30 years, I've been making my living from the labor of authors, and their care and feeding has been one of my special duties. About 5 years ago, my colleague Laura McLeod, who was at the time an editor at UBC Press, brought a manuscript into the house. It was an interesting manuscript because it touched on a number of themes that are important at UBC Press, the relationship between humankind and nature, and issues in Oriental and Aboriginal culture. But it was also a very ambitious, in fact, to call it an ambitious manuscript is probably a mild term. It was audacious. It was written by a political scientist, and yet it roamed through, in an age of hyper-specialization in academia, through literature, philosophy, cultural history, anthropology. It was also audacious because it was actively politically incorrect, I think one could say. Not only that, but it was up against the notoriously tough UBC Press peer review process, and that was 4 years ago, and it met that process, and the author took it back and revised it, and met it again, and he took it back and revised it again. This is usually a very difficult process for the academic personality, and I was amazed by how Rod Preece thrived in this process. He seemed to grow with it. The manuscript grew enormously, not so much in length, but in quality and in context. And we finally brought this to life very recently. I'd like to just share with you, except I think someone has turned the page and I've lost it. No, it may well be here. Just one phrase from this, or one. Yes, I have lost it. No, I haven't now. It appeals to the topographer in me, and I think it also captures some of the essence of what Rod Preece is telling us. To be at one with nature must involve an acquiescence, even a participation in the harm and cruelties of nature. To experience jubilation in those parts of nature that are joyous and fulfilling is to reject a part of nature. This encounter with nature involves finding moral criteria to distinguish the better from the worst parts of nature, the healthy from the diseased, the beautiful from the plain, the necessary from the plastic, the just from the unjust, the discovery of capitalized nature. It is to be at one with nature, allied with necessity, not at one with lowercase nature. With Goethe, who thought each animal an end in itself, we must recognize that a standard for judging nature, nature idealized, lies inside rather than outside of every person. The moment in work in publishing tends to be 90% dreariness, and it's punctuated by a few magical moments when we bring books to life. And the moment that this book came to life at UBC Press a few weeks ago was one of the most exciting in my 9 years there. This is my last official act as director of UBC Press, and this is in fact my last night as a resident of British Columbia. And I'm particularly pleased that I can spend it thanking Rod Preece both for this exciting experience tonight and for the wonderful experience of working with him on this book.
Okay. I'd just like one final word, because actually Peter didn't say the most important thing. It's here where it's all set out at the end, and here it is on the final page, and it's referring to the typesetting process, and it says, set in stone.
How timely it is that our next week's speaker, Professor Daniel Pauly of the Fisheries Center at UBC, is going to be next Saturday's speaker. There has not been a day for months when fisheries isn't on the front page of our newspapers. So his talk on global fisheries and marine conservation, is coexistence possible, should be a very timely and exciting topic. And I invite you all to join us next week. Mind you, on the way, if you take out a membership on the way out, you'll make me even happier.